yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Well, they're just lying. We won't be lying to you this evening on Thinking Clearly. This is Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick with co-host.
Oh, is it my turn? Oh, this is Julia Minton.
All right. Well, it's also your turn, Julia, just as we usually do to start the show off, telling folks how they can get in touch with us and how they can get the podcast version of our previous episodes of Thinking Clearly.
What episode are we on? Do you know, Bob? We're in the 30s.
It's in the 30s,
Wow.
It's 35, 36, something like that.
Amazing. Yes. So we love hearing from you, our listeners. Bob and Julia, I'm Julia. Bob and I are real people, and we love hearing from you. We have a Facebook that's very easily accessible. That is Thinking Clearly Radio Show. You can like that page, follow it, message it, leave comments. And then most of all, I love my podcasts because you can have Bob and Julia in your ears on demand. It's really exciting. So you can find that at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
Ah, very good. And you know, this is a show about evidence and trying to be accurate in our beliefs. We are, I'm going to revise what I said before, we are on episode number 39 tonight.
Awesome. That exactly. Looking, you did the research.
I did the research.
I'm very impressed.
I checked
Bob.
My notes. My memory is fallible, but my notes are pretty good.
And we're always open to updating the knowledge we have on hand.
Yes. And with our listeners' help, too. And so I've got a quote that relates to tonight's topics. By the way, we're guestless tonight. It's Bob and Julia. We do have some topics that I think are of import and interesting to the listeners. And I'm going to give you a little hint about what that is. Here's a quote. And I want you to see if you can tell who said this and when it was said. I'm going to put Julia on the spot with this. It goes like this. Quote, a certain elementary training in statistical method is becoming as necessary for everyone living in this world of today as reading and writing. Who do you think said that?
J.K. Rowling.
Okay, that's wrong, but good guess. And what year do you think that quote, whoever said it?
I think it was 2 centuries ago. I'm going to go for, what is the 19th century, Alex?
Well, this is actually 1937. I thought you'd say it was like yesterday or, you know, since 2016 or something like that.
If it was J.K. Rowling, it would have been yesterday, but I guess so. I was a century off. I was only 1 century ago.
And it was H.G. Wells. British author, science fiction writer. So back in 1937, he wrote an article called World Brain. And so that was an apropos quote back then. And it's even more important today. And that's going to be the theme of this show. That's going to be some of the topics that we're going to be talking about. The theme, actually, of the show runs through a lot of our shows. The theme is the importance of taking the time and effort to do critical thinking about selected issues in our life. We can't do critical thinking about everything in our lives because that would be our life.
Well, then. Nor would we want to.
No. It's a lot of work. And so we have to have some motivation. And so a theme that runs through many of our episodes is how important it is to actually get into search of evidence and then construct logical arguments to hook the evidence to our conclusions. So when we make claims that form our overriding beliefs, that those have some credence to them.
Yeah, that there's a basis outside of our own mind.
Exactly. Anyway, that's what we're going to get into, and the specific topics that we're going to be talking about have to do with the power of probability, knowing something about statistics and probability. Specifically, we're going to talk about base rates, and we'll get into what that means, and how neglecting information can actually, of base rates, can actually dramatically derail our decisions.
Oh, yeah, and does.
That we're
often
faced with. Often does. And we'll get into some specifics about that. It's a real important tool for critical thinkers. We're also going to just touch on how to predict future events and talk about a researcher who researches what's called super forecasting. People who have the skills to actually be more accurate mm-hmm. consistently than most other people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hear...
That's exciting.
Yeah, we're going to hear a little bit about that. And then we're going to go back. We've talked about regression to the mean or regression towards the mean. It can be said either way. We talked a little bit about that before, but we're going to re-examine that. And who knows what else we're going to get into. But we will open the phone lines about 7:40 for callers to call in and talk about the topics we're talking about or critical mm-hmm. thinking in general. Julia, does the name James Holzhauer ring a bell?
No.
Yeah, it probably doesn't ring a bell to most people. But when I tell you who James Holzhauer is,
don't ask me to spell it.
No, I'm sure it will ring a bell because he's that 34-year-old professional sports gambler from Las Vegas who kept the audience of the quiz show Jeopardy. Little bell ringing, mm-hmm. little tinkle.
They made a documentary about him.
Did they? Well, he kept folks spellbound as he gathered up $2,464,216 in winnings after 32 consecutive victories.
On Jeopardy.
And he did this by a betting strategy based on his knowledge of statistics and probability.
Now, see, I wouldn't think that would be applied to Jeopardy because Jeopardy asks you questions about things that you know. So how can the application of statistics help him be right?
Part of it was being under pressure because he's a professional gambler. So
he
could
helps.
Keep cool under pressure. But he's saying that my strategy actually minimizes the risk of losing a game and says that a lot of his strategy is based upon him knowing about probability and statistics. Well, most of us are not going to become professional gamblers, but we're often faced to try to look at what's ahead, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're planning an event. Well, what's the chance of rain?
We want outcomes to benefit us.
And we want to be able to have as accurately as we can to be able to forecast what's going on. We may want to know what are our chances of getting a job if we take the time and effort to apply for it and interview mm-hmm. for it. Mm-hmm. So we want to be able to predict some of these things.
Right, like an all-you-can-eat buffet at about 3 p.m.
Yeah. Or we might want to know who's going to be the president in 2020.
Oh, goodness. Well, that gets into the whole super forecasting.
Get our travel expenses saved up. But what it takes to make these accurate forecasts has been a subject of concern of a man whose name is Philip Tetlock. He's a researcher and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's also the co-leader of the Good Judgment Program. He wrote New York best-selling book called Super Forecasting. We're going to just listen to a short clip of Philip Tetlock, and I edited this out of a longer interview with Philip from a podcast called The Knowledge Project with Shane Parrish. And I would recommend The Knowledge Project podcast to our listeners because Shane covers some of the same areas that we do, and it's a very well-done podcast. So let's go ahead and take a listen to Philip Tetlock.
Super forecasters differ from ordinary mortals in a host of ways. They're not radically different from ordinary mortals, but they are systematically different. They tend to score higher on measures of fluid intelligence. They tend to score higher on measures of active open-mindedness. But if I had to identify one factor that I think best distinguishes super forecasters from other forecasters who are equally intelligent and equally open-minded, it is that super forecasters believe that probability estimation of real-world events is a skill that can be cultivated and is worth cultivating. And they're willing to make that commitment, that effort. So when people ask me, how could the super forecasters have outperformed, say, intelligence analysts who do this full time and have access to classified information, I think the short answer is it's not because they're smarter, and it's not because they're even more open-minded, although they are pretty open-minded. It's because they are willing to make this commitment, this act of faith, that there is a skill that is worth cultivating. So in the book, we quote Aaron Brown, who's the chief risk officer at AQR and also a great poker player, that his view is you could distinguish great players from talented amateurs on the basis that great players are good at distinguishing 60-40 bets from 40-60 bets.
Hmm.
And then he paused and says, no, maybe more like 55-45, 45-55. The greatest players tend to be extremely granular in their assessments of uncertainty. One of the big questions I think that IARPA wanted us to answer, and that I think we have answered in the affirmative, is does granularity in assessments of uncertainty pay off, not just in poker, but in when you're making messy real-world judgments, like whether Greece is going to leave the Eurozone, or what kind of mischief Putin might be up to in the Ukraine next, or what's going to happen with Sino-Japanese relations in the East China Sea, or is there going to be another outbreak of bird flu in a given region?
Right.
These are extremely idiosyncratic, one-shot historical events. It's not like poker, where you're sampling from a well-defined sampling universe, repeated play, quick feedback. So there are a lot of people, very smart people, have been skeptical for many decades that it's even possible to make probability estimates of these kinds of intelligence analytic problems. And I think what the IARPA tournament has proven, beyond reasonable doubt in my opinion, is that there is room for improvement. It's possible to make these probability estimates. It's possible to get better at it. It's possible to identify the kinds of people who learn to do it better. It's possible to develop training modules to help people do it better. And the gains in accuracy are appreciable.
What do you think, Julia?
It was fascinating.
Yeah, we may actually get into a whole episode on super forecasting. And it's worth looking into his book, which is called Super Forecasting, and then it has a subtitle to it. He lists in that book, he lists about 15, 16 characteristics of super forecasters. And I went through and highlighted, I'm not going to read them all, but I highlighted a few of my favorites because they're things that we've even talked about on this show. So these are characteristics of super forecasters according to Philip Tetlock's book, Super Forecasting. They appreciate uncertainty and like seeing things from multiple angles. They distrust their gut feelings. That might go against the grain for some people. And we've gotten a balance on this show when gut feelings come in handy and when we have to go to the more rational, slow thinking.
And one of the things I think that's really interesting about this descriptive list is we're talking about the people. And as we so often say, it's about the process of how you think and the ways in which you think. But I find it very interesting that there are individuals with certain characteristics that lend itself to being better
right.
at this sort of forecasting.
Yeah. I look at these as tools in their toolbox, their super forecasting toolbox. Another one is they treat their opinions as hypotheses to be tested, not treasures to be guarded. I love that. They constantly attack their own reasoning. They're aware of biases and actively work to oppose them. They're Bayesian, meaning that they update their current opinions with new information, and they strongly believe in the rule of chance as opposed to fate. So those are some of the characteristics of super forecasters, according to extensive studies by Philip Tetlock.
Neat.
The topic that we're going to talk about next is knowledge of base rates. What does that mean to you, base rates?
Well, I'm always reluctant to get into radio math. It sounds like we're getting into radio math again.
What are base rates? What does that mean to you?
The first thing I think about a base rate is my water bill.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what you're thinking about. base rate, if I were just to try and figure it out, I would think it's where you start. It's the base of something.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Like my water bill.
It is. And it actually is the start. It's the starting point of assessing probability if you don't have any other information except a statistic. Okay, so base rates are really statistics. Base rates are a statistic used to describe the percentage of a population that demonstrates some characteristic. So if these were those characteristics of super forecasters, we could go out and measure, if we could find a way to measure all those things, we could measure them in the general population, and then give us statistics of each one of those, how much of that was a characteristic in the general population. Let's anchor this a little bit firmer. I'm going to ask you some questions, because having a knowledge of base rates is really important. And what I found when I researched base rates a little bit is that my base rate knowledge was not very good. I would not be able to very closely and accurately predict what the base rates of some of these things are. But let's see how you do.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Here we go.
I have my thinking hat on.
Now, these are lifetime odds in the U.S. of getting killed by various things. So during a person's lifetime, what is the odds? Phrase it as 1 in 10 million or 1 in 5 or whatever, of getting killed over your lifetime in the U.S. by lightning.
By lightning?
By lightning.
Well, I think a lot of people survive lightning attacks. Lightning attacks?
People getting killed.
Did I just say it was an attack?
This is mortality.
Okay.
So 1 in what?
1 in 100 million.
Okay. 1 in 100 million. I'm going to give you feedback as we go on.
Please. Okay.
It's 1 in about 162,000.
Oh.
Exactly 161,856.
So but it's more likely I'll die from getting hit by lightning than I thought?
It is.
Oh, no.
It is. Okay, firearms discharge. In other words, gun.
Dying from a gun discharge?
Yes.
In America?
Yes. Lifetime odds?
1 in 50.
Okay, now we're going to go the other way. It's 1 in about 7,000.
Oh.
That's still 6,905. 1 in 7,000. Okay, a pedestrian incident. Hit and killed.
I was going to say, does that when I hit a pedestrian?
No. If you are a pedestrian, what's your chances of dying as a pedestrian? Probably by most likely getting killed by a car hitting you.
Man.
Could be a safe dropping off the top of a building. You're still
I've
a
heard
pedestrian.
Of that happening, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen it in cartoons. But a pedestrian incident, 1 in.
I feel like that would be somewhere close to gun discharge.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to say 1 in 7,000.
Okay, good guess. You're getting closer. See how this is working? It's actually 1 in 647.
Wait.
1 in 647.
You mean if there's 647 people here at KMUD, one of them's going to die as a pedestrian?
In their lifetime.
That's a bummer.
I know. Motor vehicle crash.
Oh, well, yeah, 1 in 500.
Okay, not bad. 1 in 114.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons I say whenever I'm visiting somebody that lives in a long distance and I'm going to drive, you know that driving is the most dangerous thing I do.
Why are you guilt tripping people, Bob?
Because I get better dinners and get to stay longer and get to be taken to, you know, better places. That's why.
All right. Truth comes out.
Okay. Now.
We did say we were not going to lie.
This is the last one. What is the probability, lifetime odds, getting killed by an air or space transport incident?
Like a satellite falling out of the sky?
Could be anything, air and transport, but it's going to be most likely.
Alien abduction?
Yeah. But for the most part, it's going to be dying in an airline accident.
Oh, in a plane.
A plane. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't happen very often.
What would you say?
1 in 1,000,000.
1 in 9,821.
Oh, that's actually higher than I thought it would be.
It's higher than maybe you'd like it to be. But then if you compare dying in a motor vehicle crash and dying in an airline, if you convert these into percentage, it's actually 86,000 times more likely that you'll die in a car accident than an airline accident.
Say that again?
86,000% more likely that you'll die in a car accident than an airline accident.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm walking where I go from now on.
Either one is dangerous, but it's much, much, much more likely that you'll die in a car accident than an airline accident.
And from my expert TV watching, I'm pretty sure that like 1 in 20 people are killed by sharks.
Wait, I didn't look up sharks, but that's very, very, very high. And that
I mean,
brings
they talk
me
about
to,
sharks all the
that
time.
That brings me to this other thing, because there's two biases. This is not looking at what the statistics are is base rate bias or the base rate fallacy, but taking whatever comes to your mind because you've seen it on TV or it's got emotional impact and using that to judge the base rate.
Yeah, there's a whole
looking it up.
There's a whole week about sharks.
Okay. Though that's called the availability bias, right? And we talked about that before.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you're doing. Sharks, that's a horrible way to die. You know, you see the blood in the water and all that kind of stuff.
And
people
like
thrashing
I said,
around.
There's a whole week on TV dedicated to it. So
exactly.
It obviously has to be a significant problem.
And so many, and Jaws. I mean, you know, so many movies about sharks and the music that goes along with it. I mean, it gets in our mind and it distorts our idea of what the likelihood is.
Yes.
Now, I didn't look up shark attack, people killed
by
shark.
But you get where I'm going.
I do. And you got us going to where we want to be going.
Just call me Transition Julia.
Exactly. So base rate neglect coupled with availability bias is what we're going to talk about in just a moment. And when I thought about this, I came up with I found a really good quote about base rate neglect. If you hear hoofbeats, look for horses, not zebras.
Cute.
I thought so.
I mean, doesn't it depend if you're in Africa or something?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you were in Africa
or like a
and
wildlife
you just
refuge.
Saw those, but see, that's that additional evidence then. Mm. That's the Bayesian approach, is you start with the base rate, and if you're in Africa, the base rate's going to be different. Horses and zebras, you look up that, and it makes that more likely. But in the United States,
right,
probably going to be horses.
But if I'm on a horse track and I hear hoofs, then
yeah,
it's probably horse.
Yeah, but the idea is that this is a starting point, and so when we're trying
to, and then when
to,
you get more information, you apply it to the statistics.
That's right.
Oh,
it's what you call your prior probability. You start out with a prior probability of something happening, and we're going to talk about some examples of this. This was discussed in an article in The Guardian, and it suggested, talking about the how much more likely it is that you're going to get killed in an auto accident than a plane accident, it suggested that in the months after the 9/11 attacks, using airliners as weapons, that the passenger miles on the main U.S. airlines fell between 12 and 20%. Airline use went down while road use jumped up. And the change is widely believed to have been caused by concerned passengers opting to drive rather than fly. And there were a couple German researchers who looked into that and did some statistics on it and analysis of this. And their estimate was that an extra 1,595, almost 1,600 Americans died in car accidents in the year after 9/11 attacks.
Because they chose to drive instead of fly.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, they should, the terrorists, at least.
So these kinds of things can be really, really important to think about.
Mm-hmm.
We tend not to think about them because we have this availability heuristic or bias, that things that are in our mind and come to mind quickly.
And it's also, we're reactive. We move through life kind of reactively. And it is, as we've mentioned before, it takes a little bit more energy and effort to think about something more thoroughly.
Yeah. And this is all under the rubric of human decision-making, and there's been a lot of research on that. Let me give you one more example here. Assume you decided to get a mammogram.
Mm-hmm.
Mammograms can detect breast cancer. And now, these figures are not exact, but let's assume that the mammogram procedure,
it's
screening. that you're taking, is 90% effective. In other words, 90% of the women who actually turn out to have cancer will get a positive test. Therefore, 10% of the time, it's going to miss that. So there'll be a false negative. And one more little fact is that assume that in about 10% of the time, the test will suggest that cancer in women who don't really have cancer, that's a false positive.
Mm-hmm.
So 90% sensitive, it misses 10% of the time, but 10% of the time, women who don't have cancers will get a positive test. Now, if you went through the screening and got a positive test, what would you estimate that your chances of having cancer would be?
What was the question again? So I get a screening.
You take this screening and you get a positive test.
Oh, I would think I have cancer. Where I mean,
give me a probability.
A lot. 90%.
90%.
I would say 90%.
Okay. Now let's say...
I would also assume that it is true until further evidence.
Uh-huh. And let's assume now that it bothered you to the point that you decided that between the time of your next follow-up appointment after that screening, that you wanted to get some information about base rates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You found a website that broke it down by your demographic, mm-hmm. sex, age, blah, blah, blah.
They're probably women.
But men can get breast cancer.
That's
though,
true.
But it's not very likely. It's not very probable. And you found out that the base rate was 1%. In other words, 1% of the population in your demographic would be expected to have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, would that change your likelihood of...
No.
It wouldn't change it at all.
No. If someone says that there's something positive in a screening, that I don't see my mind going anywhere else.
Okay.
Just saying.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But now, it's not very likely. It's only 1%.
But it's better safe than sorry.
Okay. And it does have a false positive effect. In other words, 10% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have cancer, it's going to say you do. Okay, but that wouldn't change it.
No,
change it at all for you.
Why you get a biopsy and you keep going through the system.
Okay.
And
there is a calculation that you can do with these numbers that I gave. I'm not going to take you through that because it is radio math. But you can go through a calculation. It's simple arithmetic. Addition, subtraction, multiplication, you know, maybe a division here and there. And it comes from a formula called the Bayesian formula. But you don't have to actually use that formula. You can actually put these in little grids and figure it out, too. And if you do that calculation, what do you think the probability would be if you got a positive test?
Oh, I don't know.
If you did the calculation.
I don't know.
You wouldn't
I'm
have
just,
a clue.
I'm blank. I'm
okay.
blank.
It would be 8%.
8%.
So you could get a positive test mm-hmm. with the statistics I gave.
Mm-hmm.
And you would only have an 8% chance of actually having cancer.
That's strange.
I know it's strange. That's why having an idea of what base rates are is so critical and so important. You know, I didn't understand this concept until I went to a doctor a few years back. And I always get a PSA test, which is for your prostate.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had an elevated PSA.
I've never had one of those.
Yeah, good for you. But I always like to get the test, all right? Maybe because it
sure.
feels good because it's always low. It's not ever elevated. It's never been elevated. The doctor is starting to talk to me and saying, you know, we don't encourage gentlemen your age to get a PSA test.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I had this great conversation, and he explained to me why. And his reason why is because then you have to take that next step and you have to get a biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
They may actually, even not finding cancer, they may find that some people, and I had a good friend who did that, who opted to get his prostate removed.
Wow.
Actually, just in case. Just in case they miss the cancer.
Okay? Yeah.
So sometimes the next steps, the other additional testing that they have to do to follow up, you can get infections. There's side effects to them.
It's the risk.
There's risk to them, and the risks may actually outweigh
benefits.
The
of
benefits.
It going well, yeah.
And my response to all the time that this doctor took to explain this to me was, I can handle the information, doc. I'd like the PSA.
Well, you're kind of special like that, Bob.
And I don't know what I would have done if I would have gotten an elevated. Would I have gone through and gotten a biopsy or whatever the next step is? But that's how it is with mm-hmm. our brains
especially when it comes to our own personal health. You know, like when you brought up cancer, it's like I'm just going to assume if there's a positive, I'm going to run with that assumption because that's has very serious implications for my livelihood.
Yeah.
And I do think it's even more reason to try and carefully apply some of the critical thinking skills and methods that we talk about.
Definitely.
When it comes to making personal health decisions, so often we jump to extreme intervention when in fact it comes with more risks than non-intervention.
Mm-hmm. And the little disclaimer here is always check it out with your medical professional.
Sure. We are not doctors. We only play one on the radio.
But you can impress your doctor by asking him, what is the base rate of this disease that I may have? You know, that'll impress him. All right. Well, let's get back to that. I'm going to give you a little. Have you ever had, I'm asking you this, Juliet.
Okay.
Have you ever had the perfect evening out? The weather was wonderful. You got the best table at your favorite restaurant. The food was fantastic, the wine a winner, and the conversation was fresh and spontaneous. Have you ever had?
That has never happened to me.
That's never happened.
Once or twice.
Let's just imagine that happened.
All right.
That's a fantasy.
Okay.
But then when you tried to repeat the experience, you ended up disappointed. One of the ways of making sense out of that is that your sense of experience.
Well, I set my expectations really high.
Well, or there's another explanation, is that much of your perfect evening was due to a series of chance events that just happened to fall in your favor. Hmm. In other words, it could have been at that restaurant, the service was just bad the next time, or the conversation got stuck, you got in an argument. You know, there are with everything that happens, even though we have some control over it, there's always some chance. Mm-hmm. So these are what we call historical events, right? History can't be repeated
when
exactly.
Everything aligns.
Yes, or misaligns.
True.
So a great experience often is like tossing a coin and getting a long run of heads. It's unusual and difficult to repeat. And we're going to talk about the statistical principle that's involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're taking calls about the topic or anything critical thinking. And I think we have a previous caller who called in and had a question that Nate is going to read.
Thank you. A person called in earlier, I think at the very beginning of your show, and he also had a question for later. Now's the time.
All right.
There's a lot of talk locally and nationally about having climate skeptics on climate review boards. Since you talk about skeptics, what do you think about the value of this participation contrary to 97% of scientific opinion?
Yeah, well, I would start by defining our terms. Mm-hmm. That's something we come back to. So climate skeptic is also often called climate change denier. And I think in this case, skeptic is actually kind of being used a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. What do you think? I mean, it's a similar sort of use, but I'm not sure. What do you think, Bob?
Well, it's kind of related to what in journalism is called false equivalency, meaning that, say, you have a controversial issue, but all the evidence or the majority of evidence stacks up to one side. At one time, journalism went through this idea that you had to give even the mostly improbable alternative explanation some airtime.
Mm-hmm.
And other journalists got together and said, wait a minute, that's not going to be an imperative, because otherwise, where would we ever get in terms of our news stories? For every issue, we'd have to give some opposite of that issue, mm-hmm. or some opposing issue. And that's called false equivalency. So the way I think about it, I agree with you. If the science consensus seems to be very, very highly in agreement that there is human-made climate change,
mm-hmm.
and of the experts in the field, there is a high amount of agreement. So it seems to me it's kind of false equivalency to say that therefore we have to have people who have the opposite opinion on some kind of a committee that is made and designed to do something about the eventuality of the negative impact of climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's where I'd stand on that.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, often skepticism as a movement is, you know, often comes back to evidence, scientific consensus, mm-hmm. And sort of ask those questions. I don't think skepticism as a movement, I don't think you very often see those skeptics picking up such kind of minority issues. I use that in a way in which there is not consensus. You know, last I heard, it's like 98% of the scientific community agrees about anthropomorphic climate change, or let's just call it climate change. And I think sometimes, especially in the last 10, 20 years, words are often used in a way to bring doubt, you know. And I think that's why, you know, sometimes people say, let's not call people pro-lifers, let's call them anti-abortion. Mm-hmm. Let's not call them climate skeptics. They are climate change deniers, mm-hmm. because a skeptic is open to new information and open to changing their mind.
Yeah. We have a caller, but let me just say one other thing. If I was trying to give a little counterpoint to what I just said was my opinion, and I've heard this opinion voiced, and that is that, well, on these committees, we need to have diversity of thinking. We don't want everybody to be thinking the same.
Which is a good point.
We need to have diversity of thinking. But the counterpoint to that counterpoint is, well, that diversity is going to just stall this committee. And if you have as many people with the opposite opinion, then it's just a way of politically immobilizing that committee so that it actually gets nowhere and goes nowhere and does nothing.
Right.
Which so they see it as a political
is often point. A motivation of climate change deniers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi there, and thank you for addressing my question so eloquently. Broke it down pretty well there. I tend to agree that having skeptics on a board which is trying to do a specific thing is counterproductive and is likely some kind of political ploy to keep things in an argument stage instead of actually doing anything about it. But enough about that. You were mentioning specifically about probability and super forecasters and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You made a statement, something to the effect that you feel that cultivating probability knowledge is perhaps a skill worth cultivating for some people. And I really wonder about that. Because what I heard about you talking about, like the guy on Jeopardy and et cetera, these super forecasters, quote unquote, it sounds to me like a pretty classic case of a con man. It's somebody who's basically judging or basing all of their opinions upon the statistical probability of things, which basically is necessitated by nobody changing. That, you know, it's this idea that humans are completely predictable, that we do things statistically and we go from there, which on its face I think is false, because we can always change our mind. And while things may be statistically relevant, most of us may do one thing or the other, that doesn't mean we're going to do the same thing tomorrow. So I guess how do you see a super forecaster versus just a con man who's using who we are now against ourselves?
There were two issues. One was talking about the super forecasting, and the other was looking at the fellow on Jeopardy. The super forecasters, what they're doing is they actually try to predict, just like sports figures, they keep a track record, they make a prediction, and there are tournaments, super forecasting tournaments. and people who have feel that they're good super forecasters, or who have gotten some expertise one way or the other, or maybe even taken courses, because this is something that can be taught and there is training.
Can you
available.
Give an example of the sort of things that super forecasters would forecast?
Well, it would be long or short range things. It could be the presidential election in 2020. Mm-hmm. Mostly they're into political or economic kind of events, mm-hmm. that have good coverage so that we know how the event comes out. They look at evidence, and the CIA does this all the time. They're trying to forecast what's going to happen. What's going to happen with China? You know, is North Korea going to give up their nukes? You know, is Trump's negotiation going to work?
And so then there's an investigation that takes place, in a sense. They don't just like put on their you know, magic hat and crystal ball and say, oh, I think that J.K. Rowling's going to be the next president.
They all have their own process for doing it. Hmm. And some are more successful than others, but the Super Forecasting Tournament gives them a chance to actually get a track record so that they can keep track of, anybody can predict the future and then forget about all the times they were wrong and then publicize the time they were right. Well, these people are going on record. And so if it's a short enough timeline, then they can actually be verified as to whether they predicted them or not. So these folks are not con men. These folks are people who are actually attempting to show some expertise and develop a process in being able to more accurately, it's never going to be close to 100%, but more accurately predict future events.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I would think too, just to address the con man kind of concern, mm-hmm. Is I would think that understanding the principles that the con person uses helps you identify those who are conning.
Well, I'd like to, caller, are you still there? I guess not. Well, if the caller does call back, I was going to ask him to give me an example of how a con man would use that. I don't see this as a con.
I think like the Jeopardy guy. He obviously took advantage of the situation.
Sure.
But there are no rules against it. I mean, he wasn't cheating per se.
No, he had a process. I imagine anybody who goes on Jeopardy has probably watched a lot of episodes of Jeopardy. And they've played that repeatedly. And they've gotten their own process for trying to be successful as mm-hmm. a Jeopardy contestant. And he
and
has his own process. It's just that his process is more in alignment with what he does as a profession. He's mm-hmm. a professional sports gambler. I mean, you know.
Which definitely helps as far as, you know, being under pressure and your composure and that sort of thing. So that's definitely a factor.
Yeah. The caller did mention that something about most people starting with statistics. Most people don't start with statistics. Most people start with their intuition. And that's what we're advocating here, is to complement your intuitive answers to these things, whether it's trying to predict a future event or trying to think what is the right thing to do, a moral argument, that kind of thing, to complement that with looking at statistics. Statistics is cultural adjunct to our intuitive reasoning.
Yeah, and I would speculate that even many of these super forecasters would say that intuition's a big part of what they do. Because so often that, you know, processing that information takes place in our subconscious.
You know, I don't know.
I'm speculating.
They did say that they distrust their gut feelings.
Oh, well.
You know, in other words, and I don't believe that people should distrust their gut feelings. Mm-hmm. But in my opinion, there are times when you want to put a check to that and complement those gut feelings.
Right. What I do is, regarding gut feelings or intuition, is I've started to frame it as having a conversation with myself. Mm-hmm. And it's like you have a gut feeling about something. And it's like, oh, okay, I acknowledge that. That's interesting. I wonder where that came from. Mm-hmm. I wonder why I thought that. And so often it can be insightful as to whether it there is reasoning behind it or there isn't.
Yeah. So insight can be a check on your intuition in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about regression to the mean. Regression to the mean is...
It's why we always lose at gambling.
Yeah. It's the tendency of a random variable that is highly distinct from the norm to return to normal over repeated tests. On average, observations tend to cluster around the mean. So that's where there's a bit of randomness in most things that we do. Even though we may have skill, we may think things through, we may plan them, we may try to do everything to make them come out a certain way, there's a bit of luck. There's a bit of randomness.
So like flipping a coin, you know, we were talking about that. And there is the, you can get a string of heads in a row. And maybe someone opens a door and there's a slight wind and the coin flips differently the next time.
Exactly. There's a thing in sports. It's called the Manager of the Month curse in football. It's an award won by managers who have had four or more wins in a row. And after that, what do you think happens?
They start losing.
Yes. And that's why they call it a curse. But it's not really a curse. It's regression to the mean. It also explains snake oil cures, because patients may, as a last resort, go for the snake oil cure. And they do that usually when they're at their worst. And many diseases have a natural ebb and flow. So when you see people who are at their worst, anything that even makes them a little better, or if it's just random that they got a little bit better, then you attribute it to the snake oil cure. Well, we have a clip. This is by Dr. Derek Muller, and it's from a podcast called, or actually a teaching channel on YouTube called Veritasium. So let's take a listen to this.
Imagine you have 100 students taking a test which consists of 100 true or false questions on a subject they know nothing about. Now, assuming they all answer randomly, we know that the resulting distribution of scores will have an average of around 50. But just by chance, some students will have scored significantly better or worse than the average. If you select the top 10 students whose scores were all above 50 and gave them a second very similar test, you would find that the average of their scores would drop back to around 50. Similarly, if you selected the bottom 10 students, their score on a subsequent test would rise to 50. This is just regression to the mean. Regression to the mean is the reason why if you have a really good round of golf today, your round tomorrow will not be as good. That is because random chance plays a role in virtually everything that we do. So the outcomes of events are influenced by both our skill and a little bit of luck. So if you have especially good luck on one day, chances are your level of luck will not be as good the next day. Now that sounds a little bit like the gambler's fallacy, which states that past events influence future probabilities. For example, if you flip a coin and it comes up tails a couple times, the gambler's fallacy is to expect the probability of heads to increase for the next flip. In reality, it doesn't. It's still 50-50. The idea with the gambler's fallacy is that probabilities change so that overall things even out in the long run. That's the idea. With regression to the mean, it's not that things are evening out. It's just that extreme events are becoming diluted by the average events, which happen much more commonly. Now, with these students, they were completely guessing on every question. But even when you know something about the subject, there's still going to be that element of chance. And so regression to the mean always occurs, just to a lesser extent.
And I think we do have a caller on the line, but I just want to point folks to a previous episode that we had. It was episode number 34. You can go to thinkingclearly.lipson.com. And we had a great guest, John Allen Paulos, who gave us some additional information about statistical principles that serve as important tools for critical thinkers.
So I have a question or a comment, another good question from that last caller. I really don't think we'll have time to get to it.
Is he on the line?
He is not. We have run out of time, but this could be a topic for another show. What about quantum theory as the observer changes the observed?
Well, yeah. We have 2 minutes left, and I'm not sure we're going to get to that. But that's a great question.
Yeah.
And we do love our audience participating in these conversations.
I would suggest that you listen to a podcast by Sean Carroll, who is a theoretical physicist, and the podcast is called Mindscape. And he has a couple episodes on the misuses of quantum theory. You know, quantum theory is so weird that it cannot be used to explain just about anything. Thank you very much, Nate. Good engineering job, as always. And thank you very much, Julia.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
And until next time,
keep thinking clearly.
Think for yourself, people. It's your first and your last chance.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People-Powered Radio.